federal budget done enough for housing affordability? Following last week's federal budget, a lecturer in RMIT's Centre for Urban Research and an expert in social housing policy and urban planning, Dr. Liam Davies, is going to join us now to talk about social and affordable housing in Australia and how the short-term measures may not be enough to address the current rental crisis. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning.
Well, out in the real world, the machine keeps pushing rents higher and higher despite the budget. Is there anything that can curb greed?
What we've seen in the last two budgets has been pretty substantial increases in Commonwealth rent assistance, and these are targeted payments to lower income households, and this is most certainly welcome for those households. But it doesn't even scratch the surface of the rent increases that we've been seeing in our major cities. And what I think that we need is to get back to basics of what we were doing in the post-war period and start thinking about how we actually deliver affordable housing. Because most of the policies we've been looking at for the past 20 or 30 years have been how to try and make people be able to afford exorbitant rents or be able to afford to purchase exorbitantly priced housing. And we've done nothing really systemically to create housing that is affordable from the start. And that's where I think the problem is. What we're doing is we're treating a symptom. We're not treating the cause.
Absolutely agreed on that one, because it sort of seems to initiate a feeding frenzy by landlords whenever there is some means of, you know, relaxing the stress on low-income families. It seems very counterproductive.
That's the big fear. The big fear is that what we do is we create more cash in the pockets of low-income people, low-income households, and all that does is translate to increased rents, and that means that that money doesn't actually flow to those people that we want it to flow to. It flows through those people to landlords. Also, it's probably worth mentioning that landlords have been under increased pressure at the moment, and that this is really a systemic problem, that we can't pit tenants against landlords and this against that. We have to address a whole system of why do we have such unaffordable housing, and what can we do to make housing more affordable so that landlords can charge sensible rents and households can afford those rents.
Well, why do we have housing in that situation, Liam? There must be some triggers that you've been able to identify that have ended up with us having unaffordable housing.
Unfortunately, when we talk about housing affordability, what we really always want is a simple answer of it's this or it's that, because that gives us the silver bullet solution of we do this or we do that. I think the problem with housing affordability is a problem across the developed and Western world, which really comes to the fact that we've reframed housing over the last 30 or 40 years to be an asset and a commodity away from a home and a shelter. And what that means is that people use housing as somewhere to store money and somewhere to generate wealth. And while that's okay to an extent, I think that the needle has been bent too far in that direction, and we need to start thinking about if that's actually how we want housing to be viewed in our society, or if we want housing to be viewed as a home and therefore something that is achievable for people to own, or if they don't own, live securely in.
How much
requires a bit of a step change?
Well, but talking of a step change, I mean, how much of the blame can be laid at the feet of something like negative gearing and, you know, placating what's, you know, perceived to be this, you know, vast voting mass that will have a wah-wah if negative gearing's removed? Then when you look at around one-third of Australian households rent.
Yeah, so we've got around a third of households that are renting. Around 13% of taxpayers own an investment property, and of those investors, about half are negatively geared. So what we have is actually quite a substantial number of people that are petty landlords, and I don't mean they in a derogatory way, I just mean small landholdings, who are negatively geared. And these are the types of households and types of families that probably aren't rolling in dough either. What they're trying to do is make rational decisions about how to generate income, generate wealth, and they're doing that through housing because, as you say, we have a system that encourages speculative investment in rent, in housing as rental stock. Problem is that these measures, so negative gearing is one of them, capital gains tax concessions are another, what they do is they increase people's ability to borrow against a housing asset, and that increases the value of that housing asset because people can spend more money. So maybe what we need to be thinking about is we don't get rid of negative gearing, but we say if you are a negatively geared investor, we're giving you a tax concession, you have to give us something back. And that something back might be some level of restricted rent increases and some level of increased protection for those tenants so that we have a bit of mutual obligation in this situation.
Did the budget move the needle in that direction at all?
No. We've had we've had a succession of governments who don't really want to touch negative gearing. In a way, that probably goes back to the legacy of when the Hawke government with Keating as Treasurer did temporarily remove negative gearing as a legitimate tax technique in the mid-80s. And the backlash was so strong that they reintroduced it simply take some air out of that fight. I think that now we're 20 years, we're actually almost 40 years in the past, and what we've really seen is the inflationary effect of negative gearing. Not alone, it's not just negative gearing, a whole heap of other factors, but I think that's an important part of the story.
And, I mean, is it going to be politically expedient at any stage for this negative gearing to be wound back?
I mean, I guess it depends how we consider winding it back. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe we don't get rid of it entirely, but what we do is we limit its application. And I think that in the current context where most people are, I'd say that most Australians are currently paying more than they were for housing a year or two ago, and that most Australians also know someone who's in a pretty dire housing situation. And I think that that type of awareness is going to be putting increased pressure on governments to act. And this is one way to act. The other thing they really need to do, though, is increase investment in social housing.
Well, the budget, just quoting you, it boasts measures which would deliver 55,000 dwellings over the next 5 years. But your figures indicate that we need over 160,000 social dwellings just to get back to where we were in the early 90s. It's quite a shortfall there.
Yeah, so essentially what's happened is in the last 30 years, we've stopped the wide, broad-based investment into public housing, and we've been using... So just as we've reframed housing and homes as assets and nest eggs, we've reframed public housing from a public good towards a welfare good. And what this means is that the stock hasn't really grown that much. It hasn't grown in real terms at all. It shrunk in real terms. And it's now increasingly targeted towards the lowest income households in our society. Now, these people, I'm not saying that lowest income people don't need support. They do. But the problem is when you focus a good on that, you create as a residual of what it was. You water down its potency. And what I would like to see is a return to public housing being a true public alternative, just as we see public education sitting alongside private education and a public health system sitting along a private health system. I would like to see a public housing system that sits alongside a private housing system that provides a true public alternative for people that don't want ownership, can't afford ownership, or just want a different form of security, which is what public housing can provide.
Is Australia's situation, I mean, it clearly isn't unique, but is there any country or any economy where, well, had been in a similar position, but they've managed to get out of it?
I mean, that's a really tricky question because at the moment we're seeing that this is a worldwide problem. And it's a worldwide problem because similar economic pressures and factors around deregulation from the 1960s and increasing use of financial tools and increasing strengthening of financial markets has really been a phenomenon that's occurred across the world. But we can rewind a bit to look at what we did in the past. And we had a very similar situation of very poorly regulated rents and very low home ownership in the 1940s. And what the Australian government did was they grouped together to form the Commonwealth State Housing Agreements. And through those agreements, they built 15% of all houses that were built in Australia between 1945 and 1970. And they built those as public houses and as home ownership. And that's what drove our home ownership rate up. And it meant that many in private rental had an option of also transitioning to a public system. We can also see a couple of countries in Europe that similarly, after World War II and after the Great Depression, really focused on social housing. The Netherlands now has around one third of their housing stock as social housing, and Austria in Vienna have a similar amount. And both of these countries also see very stabilized private rental markets. But the private market in that context, especially in Vienna, is competing or sitting alongside a public system that actually provides quality housing. So what it does is it raises the bar for everyone, and it means that private developers have to think not just about delivering a product that they can sell, but a product that people want.
So the framework is there then, Liam, it would seem. Tell me, in the response from the opposition and Peter Dutton, was there any jewels in there in terms of a solution?
I don't really think that any... I mean, this is tricky. Like, as I said, there's no silver bullet, and I'm not suggesting that these two measures would solve housing affordability. I think it's about having a suite of measures that moves the needle. Unfortunately, I haven't seen much promising from either political party. And while I definitely welcome the investment of 55,000 social housing dwellings over the next 5 years, it's not going to meaningfully change the needle. And some of the other discussions we're having are deeply unhelpful. I know that there's been a lot of discussion about allowing people to draw super out and use that as a deposit on their home. Well, that may help people buy a home. It's actually just going to fuel the market more. We need to stop thinking about techniques of how we can make people access exorbitant finance to leverage themselves to afford an unaffordable house, and think more about how we can make housing more affordable so people don't need to take those drastic measures.
So solutions that don't fuel the fire.
Basically, we need to stop throwing fuel on the fire.
Yeah, I guess we're back at the first question. Is there anything we can do to curb greed, Liam?
Well, I don't know if it's greed. It might be greed. I'm not too sure. I think that, as I said, people are making rational decisions about how they invest based on the current context and the current economic conditions. So I think they're the types of things that we need to think about of, are we setting signals that encourage people to speculate on housing when we don't want them to? And then how do we think about unwinding those? And that's the deeper thinking that I think we need to have in our policy. But that's also a really long-term project. We can't do that over a year or two. So in the short term, we do need increases in rent assistance so that low-income households actually aren't spending, you know, over 50% of their income on rent. But maybe we also need to be thinking, how can we restrict the amount of increases in rent? How can we also think about increasing supply of housing that's affordable? How can we think about setting signals to make people provide a quality rental dwelling? How do we think about how governments provide more housing to provide a greater diversity of options? I think it's only if we can think about it in that really holistic sense that we can find some form of solution. Unfortunately, that's really hard.
Now, it's a shame there's not too much listening going on at the federal level, Liam, but hopefully they'll start listening to the advice from people like yourself. Dr. Liam Davies, thank you very much for joining us this morning on The Record.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Liam Davies from RMIT's Centre for Urban Research and an expert in social housing policy and urban planning. He is hoping that affordable housing is going to find its way back to Australia.